What prompted me to really get into this distinction between awakening emotions and our regular emotions was really a sutta. See if I have it here. It's called the Cintana or Cintana Sutta, an act of will. And the Buddha lists several qualities that basically we think it takes an act of will for us to have, like concentration or dispassion or tranquility, that we kind of act like we have to do something in order for this quality to arise. But the Buddha said that there is no force of will. What he said was, for a person endowed with virtue, there's no need for an act of will. May freedom from remorse arise in me. It is the nature of things that freedom from remorse arise in a person that's endowed with virtue. And then basically he goes through a list of places of how tranquility arises naturally out of rapture, and rapture arises naturally out of joy. Joy arises naturally out of someone who is without remorse. It was the first time I realized that these qualities that we want in the practice don't come from our own acts of will. It comes from our practice. And then I wanted to figure out how could I cultivate this kind of a practice that the practice itself would lead to the opening of other, awakening kinds of experiences. And it starts to me with metta. It starts with a friendliness, a willingness to be in whatever moment we're in and just be with it as it is, and not always wanting something else, the way trees just stand there, loving every minute of it. So let's take some questions about what we've covered so far and begin to see how we're going to point this towards the afternoon. See what's coming up for you right now. So you're free to send a chat if you don't want to ask the question yourself. And Brian has graciously agreed to read the chats on your behalf. And if you're up for it, raise your hand and we'll just take each question in order. Yes, Eric.
Hello. So I had a question about metta practice and how to kind of refocus back. When I meditate and I'm using my breath as like my grounding, I always, if I start drifting off in thought of planning something or in the past or whatever, I always come back to my breath. So for metta, I've been trying to always come back to that feeling of welcoming, of patience, of love, of kindness that I developed, and sometimes that means getting back to, that initial person or thing that brings that kind of feeling to me. Now, I was wondering if you could give some further advice on how, like, when I'm practicing metta and I start, my attention starts drifting, how to get back to that place. And yeah, if you could offer some advice. Thank you.
Well, I think there's two types of metta people. I can't quite sense which kind of person you are, but two types. One type, the phrases alone, like the phrases and the person, helps them stay concentrated on this quality of kindness, goodwill. And then there are metta people that are more like me, that are more of a radiating type. So you're just radiating a felt sense of kindness. It's less about the phrases and more about this felt sense. So in some respects, I think that's the way you're describing metta, this kind of radiating.
Yeah. I do jump between two. Sometimes I feel really focused and very good using the phrases, but then there's other times that it's just like that sense and that feeling is really more pronounced, and it really helps me to meditate. So I kind of go between the two.
Okay, good. So what you're noticing either way is you're noticing the mind moving away from where it's at. And it's usually moving away because of this quality of don't want. It's the aversion of that moment. We think of aversion oftentimes as being some kind of negative thing, some big, you know, pushing, I don't like it. But really aversion is the not now, the moving away from this present moment. And it creates this tension as it moves away. This tension gets created as in the disconnect begins to happen. When you're talking about, it really feels sweet right there when I'm very with it. It's because in that moment, your mind and your attention is all on the present moment. And when we start moving away from it, it creates this tension of separateness. There's a this, and then there's something else that I want. So what I have found is that if I try to get back to where I was, then that tension gets even stronger because I'm trying to use a force of will to make it go back to where it should be. But clearly the where it should be is not really working right now. So what I found works better is it's like widening my acceptance. So my present moment gets wider.
Yeah.
So I have this connection and this non-connection, and both of them are okay. I'm just investigating, what is it like when I'm connected? What's it like when I'm not connected? It's okay, because my connection is with the investigation that's going on there, rather than trying to put it back to what I think it ought to be. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally. In a way, you're kind of saying that, you know, like metta practice is a bigger thing than this defined practice where I'm just saying those mantras over. It's like invite everything in. So
that's
when
right.
When this comes up, try putting my attention leaving, try to put that metta feeling or that even the mantra towards that kind of my attention leaving, and approach it with the metta kind of approach.
That's right. That's it right there. Because this quality of your attention leaving is human.
Yeah.
So it's the nature of when the mind is getting too focused. In fact, the Buddha at one point said that he noticed that even his attention on goodness and non-harm and renunciation was too much, and he was weary just from the trying to focus on that. And so instead, the middle way is that whatever arises, that we're friendly towards it. So when the mind is wandering away, we're friendly towards that, like, okay, this is all right. We'll just wander a little bit and we'll come back. It's not gone for good. And there's a way in which we can create more and more and more space around whatever is occurring.
Awesome, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I think this is Sheila. That's a great way to spell that.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Tere.
Hi.
Nice to see you again. I was
nice to see you too.
A couple of weeks ago. Oh, I'm really nervous. I find this quite difficult, but I thought I'll try and be courageous and brave and ask anyway. And
well, just take a moment and soften here for a moment. Just take a couple of breaths. It's all soft throughout around all these friends.
Anyway, you know, I think I really following and enjoying and taking in what you were saying last night and today. And I'm left, there's a almost like a sense of yes, but. There's a sense of yes, but. Mm-hmm. And metta has always been problematic for me. And the more I'm triggered, you know, the closer relationships, the story comes up, the trauma comes up, the past comes up, and the metta's gone. I am just into those, you know, those mundane emotions of every day, and I'm stuck there, and I can be stuck there for weeks and mm-hmm. maybe months and years, you know. And the places where I really want to be able to move into these awakened emotions are the places where I am most, most, you know, troubled. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this, but.
I'm sure you're not alone.
I'm just wondering, you know, the patience, like the trees, I heard that. And, you know, to have the patience of the trees, it's sort of like, it almost feels impossible to me, you know.
Yes, I know. So first, Sheila, it's actually impossible to your ego. It's not impossible for your heart. That's why you get a sense when you read a poem like that that says, oh, that's true, I know that. And the ego's like, yeah, no, not for you, not for you. Other people, maybe, but not for you. This is what I was trying to touch into last night, this closed loop thinking that our minds have. It's not you, it's not me, it's not us, it's the human mind. It's the nature of the kind of mind we have. So the patience of a tree exists simultaneously with this closed loop mind. But it's sort of like a diamond or a hologram. If you don't turn it, just skew it a little bit, you can't see it. You think, oh, it's not there. It's like the mind blinds us from our ability to see certain things. So if you hold the notion that you have to somehow or another learn how to have the patience of a tree, or you have to figure out how to somehow or another be okay with that family member that's driving my last nerve, if you have to figure that out, which is what the mind thinks, I gotta figure this out, it's not possible. Yeah. It's the problem I had with metta when I first came into the practice, because metta, as it was described, seemed completely outside of my understanding. It just seemed wimpy, superficial, not real. But that's why I propose, invite you to find a word that closely aligns with what you think is the sort of, you could think of as the root of this kind of patience that a tree would have. There's some words here that you already have access to. And you can tell when you look at babies, when you look at puppies, kittens, all those little things, we immediately turn into that felt sense. If you look at someone you really care about who's sick, we immediately turn to it. There's nothing that makes us turn to it. It's automatic. So what you're only having to deal with is when the mind is not satisfied in a present moment. It wants something different. That mind will create tension. And all that you're doing is somehow using that word to help you be okay that the tension is here. That's it. It's okay that I am irritated with this family member. It's okay that I am angry or enraged about something that came out of the blue. It's giving ourselves permission to be okay with these emotional, the regular emotions. Because when we begin to relax into and give kindness and care around the regular emotions, then what ends up happening is we get more capacity to respond out of the values of metta and not out of the ego's, I don't like this, I don't want this, that. So the only way to do that though, we can't prevent the mind from freaking out about something or getting irritated about something. That irritation shows up. What we're learning is to find the word that helps me soften a minute. Just another word for metta could be pause, just a minute, just pause, just a minute. Like when my granddaughter gets in a tizzy about something's not fixing, she gets all in upset and I'm like, just a minute, pause. Let's take a look, see what we need to do. Maybe this piece, you got to turn it and it goes in this way. And there's a way in which just the learning to take the moment to pause, that will give us enough space to be less reactive. That pause is metta. That's what I think the capacity of metta is. So you have to find a word that you will use without all the thinking mind thinking, I don't like this, without that. So whatever that word is, that's what you begin to cultivate. That word, that understanding. And gradually over time, not out of force of will, not out of make myself, gradually you use a word that aligns with your own understanding. And that understanding is what helps you open the door to metta. Do you see the difference?
Yeah, I think I certainly do. I appreciate that sort of awareness of the ego, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's all our egos. It's why it's the difficulty we have with it. So instead of trying to go with the concept of what metta is supposed to be, this conceptualized way that we think we know what it is, and I don't like that right now. I don't have access to that right now. Instead, you do have a word that you have access to anytime. You could be irritated completely, just over the top. And somebody could walk in with a newborn and it would melt you in a second. You would be like forgetting all about that. Let me see the baby. Let me look at it. Let me hold it. You'd be gentle. All of that energy would go somewhere. Just turn just like that. That is what I'm pointing to. It's always here. There is no finding metta. It's always here. But we have to find the word that most aligns with our ability to see it rather than the word that conceptually we're taught this is what it is. So there's a little saying that on my I always make posters or frame up calendar pictures because they always seem to have the great wisdom. And one of the calendar pictures I framed up said, do not follow in a teacher's footsteps. Search for what the teacher is searching for. And that's what you're doing. You're not following what the word metta means that some teacher said. You're finding, searching for that felt sense of acceptance or receptivity or compassion or any of those qualities. You're searching for that. What is that? And that felt sense will be your own word, whatever that word is. And I think once you find the word and you begin to say that word to yourself, even in the middle of tension, you're going to be surprised that all of a sudden you will begin to turn towards this quality that you think is not naturally a part of you, but it is.
Thank you.
Okay, so welcome. So is that it? You're all chilled, feeling good. I do understand we don't have a lot of words and a lot of questions because some of that is pointing to it's just in the body, kind of spinning around here, not quite sure what it is, not quite sure how to be with it. And I think that's very much a natural place to be in. Yeah, Nancy. Nancy, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, hi, Tuari.
Hi.
I don't really have a question.
That's okay.
I just wanted to comment on what you said, which is a completely different way of understanding metta to me than I've ever heard. And it's sort of what it is the essence of metta that I got. It's that okayness of whatever is arising. Yeah. And so I just wanted to thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah,
it's what the phrases is supposed to help us with. I don't know if you guys know the story of where metta came from, but this seems like an appropriate place to put it in. For those of you that don't know, but metta, it's a... There was a... You know, in the Asia, they'd have these rainy periods and monks and nuns who would normally wander about in the sun would have to find shelter because I guess the rains can get pretty serious. So they'd have to find some shelter for about 2 or 3 months to kind of stay. And that meant that wherever they stayed, the villages around them would basically be responsible for caring for these monks and nuns, providing food and clothing and medicine and whatever they needed because the monks and nuns didn't actually have anything. I think probably then it was more primarily monks didn't have anything of their own. So the Buddha would kind of people, you know, groups of monks would pick out a place and then they would go and ask the Buddha, can we stay here? And the Buddha would say yes or no. Like, is there enough, you know, not overtaxing a small village because you want to stay there. So there were about 500 monks. And I think someone said 500 just really means a lot of monks that went to this one little area, and the Buddha gave his permission for them to stay there. And they set up their walking spaces and their little kutis and stuff in this forest. And this forest had a lot of old growth trees and old spirits that lived in this forest pretty easily. So all these monks moved in, and the spirits begin to get a little like, I think they're settling in. And the monks begin to say, hey, we kind of like it here. This is a good place to be. Might even want to stay past the rains a little bit, kind of stay for a while. And the spirits are getting a little, so they decided to try to scare the monks to get them to go away, do all the little ghostly things that spirits would do to get you to get up out of here. And eventually, at first, the monks didn't really say anything to each other, because when the retreat started, they were in noble silence. So they were trying to deal with their fear that there were ghosts in the woods here without saying anything to each other. And then at some point, somebody just basically said, that's it, I'm gonna say something. And they started talking to each other, and they all agreed they could not stay there. There were spirits. It's like, did you see that? Did you hear that? This place is haunted. They decided to go to the Buddha, tell the Buddha, we can't stay there, it's haunted. And when they get there to the Buddha, it took a while to get to the Buddha. And the Buddha's like, what are you doing here? They're like, we can't stay there because it's haunted. And it's not safe. They're all scared. They're all emotional. They're caught up in a whirlwind of energy. So the Buddha gives them the metta chant. And he tells them to say this metta chant over and over and over all the way home, so that they can memorize it, so that when they get to the woods again, they could recite this chant to the spirits, and the spirits would understand and everything would be okay. So they agree, they start saying the metta chant all the way home. They say this metta chant, say this metta chant, say this metta chant. And when they get home to the woods, they say the metta chants to the spirits, but their energy is so different. They're quieter, softer, kinder, less me, like they were in the beginning. And the spirits then relax. And the monks and the spirits lived together just fine in this space. Because what had happened was their singing the metta chant had changed their temperament. They thought it was for the spirits, but really the Buddha gave them the chant to change their inner sort of, we don't like spirit, we don't like ghosts, we don't like them, we don't want them here, they gotta go. That kind of tension, we don't like, we don't like, we don't want, that aversion is what the metta chant was designed to get at. So that by the time they got back to the woods, they had a level of appreciation that they were sharing the woods with another being, and that those beings had just as much right to be there as they did, that they were softer and more respectful to the fact that there were spirits in those woods that were there before them, and they just had a softer heart. That's what the metta phrase is, even when we do it in the categories, that's what we're getting at. We're not getting at trying to change the world outside of us. We're trying to change our hearts so we have less tension around the fact that we can't control everything. Less obstruction to it. And that's why we start with people that are easily able to soften around, and we conclude with the difficult people so that we have a, by the time we get to them, we have a softer energy and we're less averse to their ways. And so this quality of radiating metta is taking the same energy and pointing it towards our judgments, our criticism, our sarcasm. We're just working with softening into, when we have a judgment, say, about something or some situation, that judgment is really just us saying, no, I don't like that. No, I don't want that. Like a 3-year-old. And all we're doing is saying that this too. So instead of being in an either or kind of thinking mind, which is the ego, it's either this or it's that. It's either this or that. It's either or, we get in an and thinking mode. So yes, it's this and it's this. I wish it were like this, and it's not like this. I don't like this, but this the way it is. There's an and quality that allows us to, now that we have an acceptance that this is in the space, whether I want it to be in the space or not. Now, how can I, in my own practice, respond to this? And I use 2 vows or 3 vows in right intention that we're going to talk about at the end today. But I ask myself, what is the least amount of harm I can do, right? So what's the kindest way I can be in this moment? What's the least amount of harm I can do? And am I willing to not always get my way? And I just keep that framework. And that's the way I move through. I get angry. Something happens. I have a fight with my son. I think about it. You know, maybe I blow up and then I think about it. I'm like, okay, what's the least amount of harm, the kindest way I can respond to this now? Sometimes it happens in the middle of the argument. Sometimes it happens before the argument stops. Sometimes it happens a couple of days after I had that argument and stewed in it for 2 days. Now I'm like, okay. But either way, I no longer hold myself to some standard that I can't argue at all. It's not I can't argue. It's emotions come up. I'm going to be reactive. And what is my response? And how can I respond to what has clearly now shown up? So this is what I want you to contemplate over lunch. You're going to be making lunch and you're going to be eating, and there's going to be this impulse to just pull out the phone and look at the phone while you're eating. You don't have to. You don't have to look at the computer. Nothing is going to change from 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock, and everything that happened at 12, you're gonna find out at 6. It really is okay. But you can instead, because the mind needs to contemplate, it needs to process. Instead, let it process. How much of my life am I just trying to not allow it to be there? How much am I trying to push away instead of just accepting this is the way things are? And what would it be like if we just included what is happening into the reality of my understanding? That's really what we're seeing. And then when we come back, we will add another set of emotions on top of this place of kindness. Okay? Good. So we'll see everybody back here at 1:30.